Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. And this is what happened earlier today in Johannesburg when the U.S. Secretary of State, Colin Powell, tried to defend America's environmental record.
The United States is taking action to meet environmental challenges, including global climate change. We are committed. We are committed not just to rhetoric and to various goals. We are committed to a $1 billion program.
The heckling was predictable. The United States has been tarred as environmentally unfriendly ever since the president said no thanks to the UN's Kyoto Accord on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Promises made and promises broken. But this country has no lock on cracked commitments. Think of the Beijing Accord on women, the Cairo Summit on population, great lists of lofty aims and promises left unkept. Think back 10 years to the Earth Summit in Rio, where everyone agreed that saving the Earth made good economic sense, and then most every nation went ahead with its mining and its fishing and its polishing of ever larger SUVs. Connection listeners, what's the point of all these U.S. summits? Are they just a high-priced forum for the squeaky wheel lobbies? We're talking specifically about the wrap-up of this week's meeting in Johannesburg. Is there useful, meaningful work that gets done? Our number's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Now, we've got a number of people lined up to join us. We're going to go first to Johannesburg, where Christian Science Monitor reporter Donna Harmon is standing by. Hi, Donna.
Hi, good afternoon.
Donna, the context of that heckling that we heard for Colin Powell, was it a routine response at this conference, or was it something that actually stood out as perhaps more dramatic?
Oh, it totally stood out, but as you said, it was to be expected. America has been the bad guy throughout this whole conference. Just the fact that Bush didn't show up here angered people, and like you said, the Kyoto Agreement, America's insistence on not setting timetables or really specific goals on a lot of the agenda issues that were being talked about, all that pretty much infuriated most of the people here, and I mean, it was clear he was going to get heckled even before he got up on the podium.
And there were some people who were actually removed from the hall?
That's right, not too many. A couple people stood up in the back with banners saying betrayal by governments or boo the Bush, I think, and then a couple people got taken out.
Donna, tell me something. The United States was the bad guy going into this summit on sustainable development. So, in truth, did anything really change?
Oh, good question. Well, America defended itself in an interesting way. I think they actually came here with some interesting proposals, to be perfectly honest. They did come with the idea of partnerships, of working not only on a governmental level, but, you know, working with non-governmental organizations, with businesses, with private public funding, all kinds of funding to work on very specific issues. They talked a lot also about the subject of accountability, that governments which are getting aid and getting help should be accountable to that good governance, sound economic policy. So those were some of the American agenda items. And, you know, although detractors would say that they sort of bulldoze those concepts over everyone else, some would admit that those are some good ideas that were brought into the pool here.
Donna, thanks for being with us.
Sure. Thank you.
Donna Harmon is Christian Science Monitor reporter. She's on the line, or was on the line, from Johannesburg, where she's covering the Summit on Sustainable Development. Now, let's introduce the other people we have on the program today. From a studio in London is Vijay Vaithiswaran. He's energy and environmental correspondent for The Economist magazine. Christopher Flavin is with us. He's president of World Watch Institute. It's a nonprofit research organization focusing on environmentally sustainable future. And Jerry Taylor is with us. Jerry is director of natural resource studies at the Cato Institute. And Jerry, I'll start with you because in your own writing about the summit, you predicted Powell's reception, saying, I think nothing plays better to the folks back home than a heaping helping of America bashing.
Well, that's absolutely correct. I'm rather cynical about these sorts of events. For the most part, UN conferences tend to be media events, and the idea is to increase the level of discussion about whatever the issue of the day might be. Whether you think that's a good thing or a bad thing really depends on which of the voices you hear out of Johannesburg. On the plus side, some of the discussion out of Johannesburg I think was useful. I mean, it turns out that there are 5 million people dying every year in the developing world from poverty-related environmental problems. Not nothing flashy like ozone depletion or global warming, but 5 million people dying because they don't have sewage treatment systems in their countries and they rely on contaminated water, and because they rely on certain renewable energies for heating and cooking needs like biomass and dung and wood and things like that, and that causes a tremendous buildup of particulate matter indoors, and it kills about 2 million people a year. These are very, very serious problems. They were discussed in Johannesburg, but unfortunately, most of the policy agendas that the non-governmental organizations and that some of the European governments brought to Johannesburg had very little to do with those problems. They were bringing in trendy Western concerns about environmental problems, and frankly, I think the discussion was going in very unproductive directions. So these sorts of conferences are useful as far as getting media attention, but I think that they're relatively unuseful as a general matter when it comes to providing reasonably sound or viable solutions to the problems they seek to address.
Christopher Flavin, Jerry calls environmental concerns trendy Western concerns.
Very much to the contrary. In Johannesburg, one of the things that was very striking was to see the level of concern in developing countries themselves, not just about issues like water and sanitation and indoor air quality, which are indeed extremely important health and environmental issues, but also a growing understanding that things like climate change are actually going to affect the poor most severely, as will the loss of forests, the loss of coral reefs, which will undermine the resource base that provides the quality of living that people living in rural areas and who are relatively poor require.
Okay, but Christopher, let me ask you about what the environmentalists are saying, because Greenpeace says this conference was worse than we could have imagined. Oxfam, a triumph for greed and self-interest. Friends of the Earth, a failing grade, a shameful abrogation. So why bother?
Well, I don't agree with those characterizations. I think that those are overstatements. Certainly, the document that was agreed to, the plan of action, could have been stronger. I would have liked to see more specific goals and timetables, but it does set some clear new directions towards things like reducing agricultural subsidies, going in the opposite direction than the U.S. Congress has recently been proceeding, and also increasing the amount of renewable energy used worldwide. The fact that you had not only the Europeans, but Brazil and other Latin American countries championing that proposal, I think is an important indicator of direction the world is headed in.
Vijay, let me hear from you. You're just back from the summit. Jerry and Chris both alluded to the way that the media is a key part of these sorts of summits. And, you know, to see the cover of The Economist magazine on sustainable development is no small feat in terms of the readership of that magazine. Is that what it's all about?
I think that the media play an important role, and in some way a collection of over 100 heads of state addressing issues like cow dung fires and basic sanitation, to me, is extraordinary. The contrast between conventional summits like, say, the Rio summit 10 years ago, which were very lofty, very ambitious, how to save the world, to down to the nitty-gritty business of what really affects people's lives. And I think there's been a dramatic change in tone at this summit. And frankly, I think it's quite useful.
You think that actually they're getting down to more practical accomplishments rather than those lofty goals?
I think that certainly at this summit, what you found was a lot more discussion of the practical aspects of the environment that affect people's lives. And I think that's, for my dollar, I would put towards poverty alleviation, things like the water, the sanitation, the things that Jerry mentioned. I think that's the first dollar that should go in environmental protection if we have a choice. And the mistake that Rio made 10 years ago, now Rio was a very inspirational summit. Anyone that was there, and there are thousands that were at Rio that turned up in Johannesburg that I talked to, you could see this wistful look in their eye. They sang and danced at Rio, and there was such an inspirational feeling that we can save the world. And 10 years later, most of them are bitter and disillusioned, saying, what is this Johannesburg summit? Where's the lofty vision? Well, I, for one, say, thank goodness. I don't believe, as a recent headline in a British newspaper put it, that we have 18 hours to help save the world. And a kind of breathless talk from a lot of activists from some newspapers and publications pumped up the summit as though it were going to save the world. And today, now that the summit is winding down, those very same people are attacking the summit for not saving the world. I mean, that whole cycle is a charade. This, you can't save the world at a gathering like this, but if you have more modest goals, you're quite focused on a list of things that we can talk about a bit, but things that are related to, in my view, environment and poverty, you can actually achieve some tangible things. And I think the summit did do that.
So back to Jerry Taylor at the Cato Institute. Do you think that this type of gathering is the right place to get those sorts of practical things done that Vijay's talking about?
No, not really. I think you'd be hard-pressed in the years ahead to identify government policies that have been substantially affected by this conference. Governments are going to do what governments are going to do, and there's very little evidence to suggest that anything discussed in Johannesburg or any of the declarations that were signed in Johannesburg are going to affect government policy positively or negatively. I don't think they have much effect.
Well certainly not government policy in this country.
Well, or in most countries. I mean, the fact is, and this is my real concern with the conference, is that the worst environmental problems by far are the poverty-related problems, as Vijay noted. Not only poor water quality and poor sanitation, and not only the reliance on these primitive heating and cooking fuels that are used in the developed world, but even things like rainforest deforestation are very poverty-related. For instance, only 10% of the wood that is cut in these tropical rainforests is exported to the West. It's not as if there's this huge demand for tropical wood that's driving deforestation. The main reason they're cutting the trees there is because they need to clear more land for agricultural purposes. Now, in the West, we don't have to do that. We have advanced Western inputs of chemicals for fertilizers and whatnot, and we have machinery and equipment that allows us to get tremendous yields out of land. But in the third world, they don't have the capital necessary for this sort of advanced agricultural practice. So if you want to increase your yields in the third world, you have to increase the land under till, and the main way to do that is to cut trees. And then the second problem is that they do need wood for heating and cooking purposes in the third world. So this is a very poverty-related issue, but there wasn't a whole lot of discussion in Johannesburg about how to deal with these poverty drivers of environmental degradation beyond give us more foreign aid. There are other ways to create wealth in the third world.
Let's check that with Christopher Flavin. Christopher, you were there.
Well, I think that there was a lot of discussion of those kinds of issues. Economic development really was a primary underlying focus of the summit. And I think that, one of the things that Jerry is missing here is that when you have a summit like this, all of the 180 or so governments that participate have to get themselves organized for the meeting. They have to consider what their plans are. They have to go back to their capitals after the conference, integrate the plan of action into national development efforts. And I do think that although we clearly have not turned around a lot of the problems ranging from poverty to water shortages to climate change since Rio, you can see a lot of, I think, very important new programs within governments, as well as new directions in industry that flowed from that.
Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. Is this the way to get things done at big international summits like the one that's just wrapping up in Johannesburg? Or is there too much fascination with the cheering and the booing of the Mugabes and the Blairs and the Powells? 1-800-423-TALK. Join our conversation about the wrapping up of the Sustainable Development Summit in Johannesburg, South Africa. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WB.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. This hour, we're discussing the Summit on Sustainable Development, which is wrapping up in Johannesburg. With me on the program today, Vijay Vaithiswaran. He's correspondent with The Economist magazine. Christopher Flavin is president of the World Watch Institute in Washington, D.C. Jerry Taylor is director of natural resource studies at the Cato Institute. And we actually started the program by talking about these summits in general. I've been to a couple of them myself. I was in Kyoto. I was also in Beijing at the Women's Conference. And you might remember there were two conferences going on in Beijing at the same time as the formal UN conference where the speeches were being delivered, and then a second sort of off-campus NGO conference being held where all the really exciting things were done. I happen to have drawn the long straw. I was at the UN conference recording all the speeches and thought to myself at the time, what a colossal waste of time. Although I will say that when I went back to what was then my home in India and met people who'd been at the formal part of the conference, they thought that the opportunity to just go somewhere else, talk to other people, meet people who had the same sort of problems or dilemmas that they did, was useful enough, was a meaningful enough part of the exercise. They're very persuasive about that. And Vijay, perhaps I can get you to begin with that. You made a reference to the partnerships. We know that BMW was there talking up its environmentally friendly research on cars. Shell was there talking about its partnerships with environmentalists. Is that really what we ought to be focusing on rather than the political?
Well, I think you certainly need both. There are certainly some things that only governments can do, and it's important to recognize that. Things like tackling climate change, for example. There are some environmental problems that are uniquely international, intra-regional. The list is actually quite short of these problems, ozone depletion and so on. But there you clearly need some sort of governmental treaties to set the framework for the rest of the world, for business or individuals. But what this summit is really about, sustainable development, which is a very slippery idea that tries to tie together economic development and environmental protection. They don't always go together. There are often many trade-offs. And it's quite hard to do, as we've discovered since Rio. And I think that one of the strengths of this summit is the messy, confused, energetic alternative summit that was going on, except this time the UN blessed it. They made it part of the process, unlike it at Beijing that you referred to. Activists, there were all kinds of community organizations, companies like the Shell and other sustainable development companies that are committed to that topic. What you had was something like a trade fair for sustainable development with hundreds, even thousands of ideas being exchanged. I think this is the kind of nitty-gritty that the building blocks from which sustainability will emerge, not from grand visions that are taking place in the UN conference necessarily. And that's worth doing in its own right.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to Newton, Massachusetts. Anne's on the line. Hi, Anne.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm just really thrilled that you're holding this, discussing this topic today, because I've been really concerned about the lack of coverage here in the U.S. on this summit, and I think it's very important. I think the question you raise is this summit important, is a good question. I think, as somebody, one of your guests said, it helps really. Environment is a global issue. It's not a local issue anymore. We can't deal with it as an individual state or an individual country. So looking at it and coming together as a global body is really important to look at these issues. Whether or not that allows us to solve the problems, it's an important place to have a forum and to come together. And it also causes governments in preparation, I think somebody mentioned this, to think about it and prepare for the summit. But I think the third piece that was mentioned was the issue of the media, and it, you know, that these things are just a media forum, I think is really an important issue that the U.S. Media has really dropped the ball on. I've been struck how when I listen to BBC in the morning, every week the BBC has led with this summit. That has been the first thing they've talked about. And yet when I listen on NPR, it's not mentioned at all, or it's the third or fourth or fifth or sixth topic. In the Boston Globe, I think yesterday was the first time that there was a front page article on the summit. And
I was listening to the radio in Canada over the weekend, Anne, and it was the number one story up there. There's no question about it, Christopher Flavin, that the imbalance in coverage in Europe, in the papers in the developing world as compared to the United States has been a notable feature of this particular summit. What does that mean?
It was not only notable, but it was really a striking contrast with Rio. I don't know if you remember, but Rio really was front page news and led the newscasts.
It probably helped the President Bush 41 was there at the summit. That tends to focus the nation's attention, doesn't it?
And also the controversy over whether he was going to go. But I also think that, unfortunately, this does reflect sort of a gradual shift. The U.S. government is a lot less interested in a lot of these issues, not only the environmental ones, but many of the social issues as well, compared to the direction that a lot of the rest of the world is moving in. And I do think that there's something here that we need to pay attention to, because I think it's, you know, particularly as we look at things like potential U.S. involvement in Iraq and our broader commitment to multilateral action around the world, I think that this increasing split is something that not only the Bush administration, but all of us should be concerned about.
If I can, I think that's just silly. I mean, the media is going to play up stories that it thinks people want to hear about. In Europe, in Canada, in other parts of the globe, people seem more interested in environmental confabs like this and more interested in the discussion than the media thinks they are in the United States, and I think that's probably somewhat justified. It's a judgment call. I mean, it's not up to the Bush administration whether NPR covers the Johannesburg summit a lot or literal or just a somewhat, or what Fox or CNN does. I mean, these are newsmakers. These are people in the media who are making judgments, and believe me, I've been on a number of these shows. Most of the producers are very interested in this stuff, but they have to decide what they think Americans want to hear about. And if they're wrong about that, you know, Chris, you might be right. Maybe Americans are clamoring to learn more. Then they made an honest mistake in new judgment. But
that's right.
I hear this sort of thing all the time from people who complain that their Right to Life rally didn't get as much notice as it should have or whatnot. It's just a news judgment.
Okay, but hang on, because the administration does have the ability here to say this is important or this is not important, as long as, you know, the people in the executive are talking about what's going to happen in Iraq and what's going on with the economy rather than talking about the environment, then to that extent, the elected politicians have the ability.
I don't think so. Do people at NPR really decide to cover something a lot or not cover something a lot based on what Ari Fleischer says is important?
No, but I bet you that if President Bush had gone to Johannesburg, you might have got a little bit more coverage in this country.
Well, it might have. And one of the reasons he didn't go to Johannesburg is that he knew that he was going to be beaten on like a Mexican pinata the same way that Colin Powell did. So why should he go? I mean, he's not a stupid politician. But his not going itself was a news story.
If I can jump in,
Dick, itself could be covered.
I think that in that point, I think Jerry's wrong. I think Bush should have gone. And the reason is, in his absence, every imaginable problem in the world is being pinned on the United States. Now, I think the United States is, this administration is wrong on Kyoto, on climate change. They made how they pulled out of the Kyoto Treaty was misguided, even buffoonish, and they managed to create a lot of ill will at a time that they need international cooperation for the war on terrorism and lots of other things. But basically, I think the record has been pretty good of this administration in the run-up to the summit. If you saw what they did on aid, they've announced a big package of aid, $5 billion in incremental money that came at the Monterrey summit, which is a little while ago. They've announced a substantial contribution to something called the Global Environment Facility, which it was quite a surprise. They're giving new, fresh money to environmental issues around the world. So in a number of important ways, they have not been the bad guy that's being portrayed in the world's media and by the world's environmental groups. Bush should have gone, stood up proudly and said, hey, we don't agree with everything you're talking about, but here's what we've done, and we're quite proud of it, and here's why we think this way is best. Instead of doing that, he's allowed America to become the whipping boy and lets the Europeans, for example, off the hook on a lot of things that they frankly need to be ashamed about, like agricultural subsidies, which keep the poor countries poor. Agriculture is one of the few things that poor countries can do well, and Europe has the highest level of agricultural protectionism in the world.
Jerry, once back.
Even more than America.
To you.
Oh, look, I agree, but if Vijay thinks that Bush having taken the podium would have gotten anything but even lustier and louder boos than what Colin Powell got, I think he's living in political never-never land.
And you don't think there's any value in basically facing your critics?
Bush has a lot of things on his mind right now. We're trying to decide whether to initiate a war in Iraq, which is a pretty weighty decision. The United States economy is lying flat on its back. There are a lot of things on the president's plate, and I think most Americans, as evinced by the judgment of news producers, are probably thinking about other things right now, and I'm somewhat glad that the president's thinking about what I consider to be more immediate, more important concerns than those raised in this conference.
Okay, Ann, thanks a lot for your call. You obviously touched on something that... interesting way of looking at this.
You know, I have to say, I just keep thinking the media
people are interested in stories in part because of how the media plays it. And if the media doesn't play it and doesn't tell us about it, then only the people who are the diehards are going to know what's going on. And the average Joe isn't even going to know it's there. And then for the media to say, well, the people aren't interested because we didn't run it because the people weren't interested, you know, it's chicken and the egg. I'm not sure which is coming first. I think the media
figure it out, call me back.
All right. Okay. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
1-800-423-8255 to Arlington, Massachusetts. Courtney's joining us. Hi, Courtney.
Hi, Dick. How are you doing?
Good.
This morning. I think it's unfortunate that we're having such a cynical sort of twist to this spin to Johannesburg. It seems to me that it's predictable that any U.S. discussion would be trying to downplay, you know, global agreements, because we're the big superpower, so we don't have to play. You know, we can take our ball away if we don't want to play. It seems like we should change the framework a little bit and look at what's been happening to the environment just this year. You know, with the flooding in Europe, with the fires, 2 million acres of fire, you know, fire in forests burned up this summer. So it seems that the public, the American public, would have liked to have been down there at Johannesburg, you know, having its voice. And the alarm, I think, that people feel. I mean, we can talk about, yes, the American economy is in the tank, and there's a lot of reasons to look, you know, sort of avoid the issue, you know, sort of put it in the back burner. But the writing's on the wall. We need to have the Johannesburg meeting was a broad brushstroke, large attempt to try to wake up people like the United States.
Well, Courtney, let's just check with Christopher and Vijay on that, because while we have been up to this point more talking about who was representing the United States from the administration, there were, Christopher, why don't you start, I assume, a great number of American corporate leaders, of American environmentalists, of American policymakers there.
Exactly. There really was a very large American presence. And I think that one of the things that is unfortunate because of the way the Bush administration has positioned itself, and I do think that the rhetoric is really, I agree with Vijay on this, a bit worse than the reality. They're certainly not doing everything they might policy-wise. I agree that the pullout of the Kyoto Protocol was unfortunate, but really they are, I think, unnecessarily making themselves the bad guy. The fact is that there is a lot of a very positive development that's underway in the U.S. by companies, by non-governmental groups. Many of those entities are involved in the kinds of partnerships that were discussed earlier. So I think that the U.S. really needs to make an effort to really sort of reposition its rhetoric and the way it works on these issues, because the fact is that the U.S. is clearly not the only problem here. For example, the very bitter dispute that developed over renewable energy targets, some of the developing countries, including most of the members of OPEC, were just as prominent in their opposition and really did in those targets. But the U.S. ended up getting all of the blame from the non-governmental organizations, which I think in many ways was unfair. But if the Bush administration had played it a bit more smartly, that would not have occurred.
Vijay, anything to add?
Yeah, I'll tell you, the irony is this administration walked out of, in a sense, the only U.N. conference that promoted the values that it's been talking about. This is a summit that I think in 10 years will be remembered for recognizing the limits of government, a theme that resonates very much with Bush and his administration. There are no big set-piece global treaties to be signed at Johannesburg, for example. Like at Rio, there was the Climate Change Treaty, the Biodiversity Treaty, Desertification Treaty. There's nothing like that here at Johannesburg. What we saw instead was, in a couple of important ways, a recognition of the limits of government action, coming from the failure of Rio to achieve very much, frankly. One of those things we've talked about is the role of non-governmental actors, partnerships with business, with NGOs, this whole flurry of initiatives that the U.S. actually played a big role in at Johannesburg by starting up some of these. I think that is a recognition that governments can't do it all. We need help from whatever works, whether it's companies in partnership with a local NGO, et cetera. And the other area where we saw this summit go far beyond, I think, anything else the UN has done. For example, on AIDS, the UN AIDS organization said it's going to bypass governments that aren't doing anything on AIDS and fund corporations directly. Corporations like De Beers, the Diamond Company, and Anglo-American, a very big mining company, have said they're going to distribute HIV drugs directly to their employees, frankly, because their government is negligent in South Africa. And the UN agency in charge, you might think, would be very bureaucratic, very intergovernmental, quite courageously stood up and said, this is great. We're going to give you money and expertise to help you do that. That's the kind of thing that the Bush administration could stand arm in arm with and say, yes, this is good, whatever works. Let's not rely on the bureaucracy of government and only to do this. We need to look outside and look for innovative ideas and experimentation.
Okay, we're coming up to a break. I want to see if I can squeak one more call in. So, Courtney, I'll thank you for your call. And we'll go to Cambridge, Massachusetts. George is on the line. Hi, George.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I listen to The Connection on a solar dynamo radio, so I guess I'm doing my part.
We're coming in clear, I hope.
Yeah, very clear. No, there's no loss in quality of my life because I've gone renewable for that small extent. And I'm also trying to think about one window applications of solar electricity and other forms of energy and have been for many years. So I'm interested in this topic. And there are two things that I want to say, one of which is just a reiteration of something said before, but using a quote from Lenny Bruce, the only justice in the halls of justice is in the halls. The only real conferring at conferences like these are at the informal gatherings that happen, those meetings that are just surreptitious, you know, and serendipitous among the people who might normally not get to meet. The other thing is that I've been following daily on the www.dailysummit.net the proceedings, and according to that publication, the American PR they don't even know how to hold a press conference, according to them. So, you know, surely we have a Bush League operation all the way around. Not only do we not participate fully, but we don't even bring professionalism to whatever case we have.
George, I'm going to have to let you go because we're coming up to our break. I want to thank you for your call. 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, we're trying to figure out what the value of these UN summits is, if there is a value, or are they just a big talk fest, and interested in hearing from you. 1-800-423-TALK. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the World Summit on Sustainable Development, and so was the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan speaking at the summit earlier.
The legacy of this summit goes beyond the political commitment to accelerate action for sustainable development. Instead of concluding only with the adoption of the political agreement, the summit has generated real action through partnerships by and between governments with civil society, business, and others. And I hope it will make a real difference on the ground.
Hope it will make a real difference on the ground. Connection listeners, do these things make a difference? 1-800-423-8255. We're going first to New Hampshire. Robert's on the line. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks
for
calling.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I hear you fine.
My reaction through the summit comes like this. I believe that you have a bunch of political zealots with an environmental program that get in front of the people that are trying to make presentations there and harangue and harass. And frankly, I don't know why anybody should put up with it, Powell or Bush or anyone else. I've had experiences in dealing with environmental types on a practical business basis where they came in and harassed me running a company. What was it? The Environmental Defense Fund. And when I got finished, they had to write an apology to me because they did something improper and they were nailed for it. But it meant that I spent $60,000, $70,000 with legal expenses as a result of it. My attorney advised me not to sue them for those costs, but they bloody well should have paid it. The other thing I noticed, as Sulla mentioned, that the forests were a major issue in terms of the environmental world, and that's true. There was a hell of a lot of fires in this country this year that continue to go on, but when you realize that 40% of the Forestry Service's budget is burnt away by trying to deal with opposition to properly caring for the forest, I say the environmentalists are responsible for the destruction far more than the lack of rain or anything else.
Robert, if I can, let me get Christopher Flavin to talk about the environmentalists' role at a conference like this. And Chris, maybe you can deal with the first part of what Robert raised, that the people at conferences like these just want to talk, don't want to listen. I think, Robert, that's probably fair to characterize what you're saying.
That's a fair way of putting it.
Chris?
Well, I think you're characterizing a very small proportion of those that were at the conference. You know, I found the kind of reaction that Colin Powell received earlier today to be unfortunate as well. But the people that were involved in that are a tiny, tiny proportion, and the vast majority.
Very vocal and very likely to pop up in a television news report, though, right? As
yeah,
representing.
Let me tell you something. All I know about the environmentalists is based on personal experiences in my business.
Okay, but let's go back to Chris because I jumped in on him, Chris.
Yeah, and I just think that the environmental movement is far broader and far more constructive than what your experience has been.
Would
apparently.
You call the Forest Service problem constructive or destructive?
Well, that's not a problem I have a lot of familiarity with.
Well, you don't have to be too bright to know that 40% of their budget goes for fighting off the environmentalists who won't let them properly care for the forest, and now are having the fires that they want to hide under a rock.
Robert, in fairness to Chris, rather than go down that debate, which is an interesting one, but a little bit off the topic here, do you or would you concede that some of what happens or some of what has happened in terms of improving the environment is also due to the work of environmentalists who perhaps lobby a little more quietly, get their stuff done behind the scenes? Or do you think the vocal ones, the ones that you're criticizing, basically stand for the rest of them?
My reaction is this, is I am not anti the environment, be clear on that. But I am reacting to the zealots and the loudmouths that seem to precipitate all of the activity. I'm telling you, based on personal experience, I spent money to fight off a bunch that were doing no more than trying to blackmail me into giving them money to perpetuate their existence. And I think that's a lot of trash.
Robert, I want to thank you for your call and ask Jerry Taylor from the Cato Institute how in the, you know, from the perspective of your office, you characterize the conversation as it exists today, whether or not it's changed. Is it any more civil? Is it any more constructive than it, say, might have been in Rio 10 years ago?
It depends on the conversation. It depends on the environmentalist. Just yesterday, I was on a public radio program in New York with the president of the Sierra Club, Carl Pope. We had a very civil and pleasant discussion. We don't agree on everything, but it was civil. In other occasions, however, these things are very far from civil. But let's bring it back to Johannesburg for a moment. One of the things that struck me is that there are sorts of two kinds of environmentalists who came on to Johannesburg. Those who are really primarily interested in solving environmental problems, and those who are primarily interested in attacking Western capitalism, and the environment is simply the biggest front for doing that these days. For instance, the United States, as Vijay mentioned, came to the summit with a major initiative to work in partnership with corporations to build infrastructure that would allow for sewage treatment electrification for the millions of people, actually billions of people around the world who don't have access to those things. And as we mentioned before, 5 million people die every year because they don't have an electricity system that wire up their homes and because they don't have sewage treatment. Now, the United States had this a proposal because when we've tried to give foreign aid to governments to do this in the past, the money's been frittered away, it's been a victim of corruption, and so instead of the idea was to cut out the middleman and just directly invest in building this infrastructure. What happened? According to Reuters, a report that I read the other day and I saw in some other press outlets, a number of environmentalists went crazy and said, you know, this is outrageous because this is just trying to get corporations to make a profit. This is just a way to make make a buck off the environment. Now, are you in favor of helping poor people solve their problems, or aren't you? If you are, then it should be an open question about how best to go about that. It shouldn't be off a discussion off the table to work directly with the companies who ultimately are going to have to build this stuff. The idea that the environmentalists are promoting, which is, this, it's all well and good to help poor people, it's all well and good to address environmental problems, but if anybody's going to make a buck off it, then it's got to be stopped, to me, is absurd. Now, not all environmentalists took that position, as I'm sure Chris will jump in and say, and that's true. But enough of them did that it dominated the press reports out of Johannesburg that day. And to me, it just struck me as bizarre.
Let's move along, if we can. Robert has left us. Thanks, Robert. To Virginia Beach, Virginia now, and Friedrich's on the line. Friedrich.
Yes, thanks for taking my call, Dick.
Mm-hmm.
I am a graduate student in economics at Old Dominion University here in Virginia. And you asked the question, do these things make a difference? I wholeheartedly agree. They do make a difference. They are focusing attention on an issue which really needs their attention. And I should give you a typical example. You say that the Economist, you know, put it on the front page. Time magazine did a spread also last week about the same topic. And I think it's important that people need to know and understand that the resources we have in the world are finite, and we are using them at a rate which is not sustainable. That's the first point I want to make.
Friedrich, tell me, though, what difference it makes to put something on the cover of a magazine.
Because remember when you talk about nowadays eyeballs, the more people who get to see this, the more sensitized they get to the real problem we're dealing with. So a lot of attention has been focused on the U.S. involvement. And, yeah, we'd like to see a much more involved U.S. There's no doubt about that. But people keep on forgetting that countries act in their self-interest just like people act in their self-interest. And if that is the basic primary motivation, then the position George Bush is taking is just simply to be sure that he gets reelected and is representing the self-interest of his constituents. So what I would really like to see is developing countries to understand that it is nice to have the support, it is nice to have the help of developed countries, but it is also in their own self-interest to go out and actually see ways in which they can improve the lives of their people. We cannot always wait to hear, you know, help from the U.S. or from the European Union, because guess what? Whether they put subsidies on, they're acting in their self-interest. So really what I would love to see, you know, go on is better governance in developing countries, much more effective government, and really a government which, you know, works to uplift the general standards of living for their people.
Friedrich, let me ask Vijay back into the conversation, because, Vijay, it seems to me that self-interest was very much at the heart of what Powell was talking about, that the self-interest of the United States is, you know, in safety and the economic well-being of the rest of the world. And quarrel as people might with the record, the environmental record of the administration, is Friedrich, in effect, defining the way ahead, even if we are to look at it at some kind of higher-minded level?
I think he's quite right to say that the awareness of these issues can only help. Thinking, whether it's on the cover of my magazine or others, the fact that people are focusing on a very difficult question, that is, how to reconcile the need to help the world's poorest people, that is, development, with the concerns about the environment. I think that's very important. I would, and the reason is that there are many trade-offs involved, and that's really what this comes down to, in my view. Single issue activists, whether they're lobbying just for the rainforest or whether they're lobbying just for some other pet cause, often miss the point that in the real world there are often trade-offs. Not everything is a win-win, and it's not always possible to preserve every aspect of the environment and advance the war on poverty. I think then that's bringing all these people under one umbrella. The one useful thing it does is force people to really recognize, hang on a minute, there's some things that we can't achieve, and what are the limits, for example, in environmental protection? Is it right, for example, for a poor country in Africa to have the same environmental standards as California? What does it mean for development? I think that those trade-offs come right to the fore when you put this kind of a spotlight on it and under one forum.
Sure.
Yeah, the other point I'd make very quickly is that There's another positive effect of these forums. When you have, for example, and that's to hold the leaders of the world in check, there are times when self-interest leads to bad outcomes. For example, agricultural subsidies. I think most reasonable people would agree that the kinds of subsidies that are lavished by rich countries on their farmers are one of the main reasons that poor countries stay poor. Same thing with subsidies on things like coal, environmentally harmful forms of fossil fuel. It's very hard for countries, because of domestic political lobbies, to get over that. The fact that the French government has signed on in public to reducing agricultural subsidies and phasing them out, the next time this is discussed in Europe to reform their agricultural subsidies, the French government can be shamed in public by, when their colleagues from other European countries say, look, you signed on to this at Johannesburg, you better face up to your farmers. It's no guarantee that it will happen, but it certainly doesn't hurt. It's a step in the right direction. Mm-hmm. I, for one, welcome it.
Let me go to Jerry on this, because the Canadian Prime Minister says he's going to put the Kyoto Agreement to a vote in Parliament. The Russian Prime Minister announces that, yes, in fact, they'll do what they can to ratify the Kyoto Protocol. Do those events and others like them mean that maybe there's some reason to have meetings like this?
Well, that's one of the reasons that I don't care for meetings like this. As Lawrence Summers, who used to be the Secretary of Treasury under the Clinton administration, once said, you know, when, anybody who thinks that passing the Kyoto Protocol is doing anybody a favor in the third world is kidding themselves. And the main reason is that while we're talking about global warming, as I mentioned, 5 million people die every year from poverty-related environmental problems. Now, there's just no conceivable scenario where global warming is going to kill that many people in a given year. This is the immediate here and now problem. The main way to solve this problem is to create wealth in the developing world and to provide for electrification. Both of those things will be far more difficult to greater the extent to which governments try to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The main reason being is the only way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions is to increase the price of fossil fuels. And if you increase the price of fossil fuels, you'll make it harder to electrify many of these parts of the developing world, and you'll make it very harder for these countries to provide for economic growth. So this is when I early in the show, when I talked about exporting trendy Western concerns into the developing world, this is exactly what I mean. Here and now, 5 million people die a year. And what are we doing? We're emoting about global warming. It's not doing any of these people a favor.
Christopher Flavin, what are you going to remember the Johannesburg summit for? What's the headline going to be on this one?
Well, I think it's a small but important step in the right direction, and I do think that we have a new understanding of the issues that's coming out of Johannesburg, as well as a new commitment to go forward, both in the private sector and in the public sector. And I think that there is an understanding that's growing around the world that we're going to need change. We're going to need change in investment patterns. We're also going to need some important changes in government policy. I think the focus on governance by the Bush administration was a right move. And unfortunately, though, I don't think they seem to understand that we're going to need some significant changes in U.S. policy as well as in the developing countries.
Chris, thanks for being with us. Christopher Flavins, president of the World Watch Institute in Washington, D.C. Vijay, thanks a lot for your time.
My pleasure.
Vijay Vaitheswaran is energy and environmental correspondent for The Economist magazine. And Jerry Taylor, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Jerry's director of natural resource studies at the Cato Institute. Thanks to Friedrich for calling in. Earlier in the program, we talked with Donna Harmon, Christian Science Monitor reporter based in Johannesburg. Connection listeners, we invite you to continue the conversation on our forums. You'll find us online at theconnection.org. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Orit Koritsky-Fox, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. We had help today from Kim Bichari, Dara Manoogian, Brian Myers, and Carl Volker. Our intern is Clint Cavanaugh. Graham Smith's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.
This is WBUR.